elections with different laws all over the country that apply to ballot access. It's really important for the United States Supreme Court to weigh in on this. They are the ultimate arbiter of what the United States Constitution says.
So if Colorado's decision gets struck down, Maine becomes like a domino. It gets struck down too, pretty much?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to see how this plays out, obviously. We've never had this happen. And the Maine Secretary of State's decision acknowledges that this is the first time a presidential candidate has been removed for having violated the 14th Amendment. The United States Supreme Court has not ruled on a case like this before. The 14th Amendment exists for a reason. It's still on the books. It's important. It's been applied as recently as last year. And of course, the former president's actions really call into question as to whether or not he, as an individual, as a candidate, did violate the 14th Amendment by engaging in an insurrection and therefore would be disqualified from the presidency.
If the U.S. Supreme Court decides this matter for the entire country, does it even make sense then for states to even do this, even attempt to decide whether or not the former president is qualified based on the 14th Amendment clause?
Well, because of the way that these cases ultimately get to the United States Supreme Court, you can't just file a case in the United States Supreme Court and ask them to rule on this. We need some of these cases to work their way up through the various judicial systems in the states and hopefully put some pressure on the Supreme Court to rule as quickly as possible. It's essential that a clear ruling is issued by the United States Supreme Court as soon as possible, not just for the voters, but also for election officials who are starting to print ballots up for the primaries, and also for the Republican Party that needs to know whether or not it has a candidate that is qualified to serve as president of the United States.
And what's a reason why maybe the Supreme Court hasn't done this yet? Or you think they're waiting maybe to see how other states handle this?
Well, so far, the first case, you know, worked its way up. There's been a petition to the Supreme Court. It just got filed very, very recently. Presumably, former President Trump will issue another petition, and that'll be heard by the United States Supreme Court. I have a lot of confidence that they're going to recognize the urgency of this and come to a decision fairly soon so the entire country can know whether or not Donald Trump is a qualified candidate.
David Becker is Executive Director for the Center of Election Innovation and Research. David, thanks.
Thank you.
NPR's Greg Myrie has covered many wars. This year, he's reported on Israel's fight against Hamas and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. As the year winds down, he offers this look on the conflicts and the prospects for bringing them to an end.
When I called historian Ann Applebaum to talk about the wars currently raging, she offered this stark assessment.
I think we've reached the end of a particular period in history when it was even possible to talk about some kind of universal values or rules.
I've seen this lack of restraint in Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It includes deserted villages, scorched homes, abducted children, and mass graves. Applebaum, who writes for The Atlantic, sees Russia's actions as part of a broader move by autocratic leaders and groups that reject many international norms established after World War II.
The tactics have been hit civilians, hit sites of industrial production, hit the electricity grid, hit hospitals. The war in Ukraine is really an attack on those laws, on that system itself.
In covering the Russia-Ukraine war and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, recurring themes keep jumping out. Both wars stretch back generations. What we're witnessing is just the latest eruption. Modern weaponry makes them deadlier, and accumulated hatreds make them harder than ever to resolve. At an Israeli military office, I saw a 45-minute video with gruesome scenes of Hamas militants rampaging through southern Israel. Much of the footage came from Hamas militants wearing body cameras, filming themselves as they slaughtered Israeli civilians. In its response, Israel's military says its operation in Gaza targets Hamas, not Palestinian civilians. Yet this is the fourth Israeli conflict I've covered. Israel has never unleashed such a massive bombing campaign in such densely packed civilian areas as it's doing daily in Gaza, with predictable results: the deaths of thousands of women and children. Ian Bremmer is a global affairs analyst who runs the Eurasia Group. He sees two wars that will be very hard to solve.
The Ukrainians believe a genocide has been committed against them. The Russians don't think Ukraine has a right to exist.
The Mideast war is equally grim.
Historically, Israel-Palestine has been the most challenging geopolitical issue out there. I don't think it's getting any easier with this war.
Here's why. Israelis and Palestinians fought their first war in 1948. Now, 75 years later, the leading Palestinian faction, Hamas, says it wants to destroy Israel. And Israel's long-serving Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, vows to eradicate Hamas. During my most recent time in the Middle East, I was struck by how views have shifted across the spectrum, even among those who support an eventual peace deal.
Look, we need a new administration in Gaza.
Irel Margalit is a leading Israeli high-tech entrepreneur. He used to be in parliament, the Knesset, with the Liberal Labor Party, which supports a Palestinian state. He's a sharp critic of Netanyahu and says Israel needs a new government. He also says Hamas needs to be replaced with a
Palestinian administration that's willing to build life rather than death, willing to build schools which don't have ammunition right underneath them, willing to build hospitals which doesn't have a maze of tunnels right underneath them.
In the past, I traveled to Gaza dozens of times on my own. Now, Israel's bombing campaign has made it too dangerous. The military has only taken journalists in on brief, chaperoned visits. NPR's Palestinian producer, Anas Baba, has been our eyes and ears in Gaza. He recently described his devastated hometown, Gaza City, this way.
This is not my city. I cannot even realize what street it is. I only can smell death, dead body under the rubbles. Nothing is the same.
The story of the intractable Israeli-Palestinian feud is well known. Far fewer know the history of the Russia-Ukraine dispute. Ukraine declared independence from Russia after the 1917 Russian Revolution, but didn't manage to break away until the Soviet Union fractured in 1991. That Ukrainian independence has been under assault since Russia's Vladimir Putin invaded in 2014. Dmitry Alperovich, who was born in Russia, now heads a Washington think tank, the Silverado Policy Accelerator. He's a fierce critic of Putin.
For Putin, it's really not about whether he can capture a village and keep it occupied. His determination from day one has been to control Ukraine, to prevent Ukraine from being part of the Western alliance.
Ukraine wants to recapture lost territory. More importantly, he says, it seeks the long-term protection that would come with membership in NATO.
What Ukraine really wants is stability and security for its country to prevent another invasion from Russia. And that's much more challenging to achieve.
The U.S. plays a critical role in both wars, but may not be able to forge the outcome it wants in either conflict. One reason is that U.S. foreign policy has become much more fickle. Once upon a time, Democrats and Republicans worked together on foreign policy under the notion that politics end at the water's edge. Not anymore, says Ann Applebaum.
In an era of really harsh partisanship, it will be much more difficult to maintain a consistent foreign policy over time.
President Biden's plan to send more military aid to Ukraine is now blocked by Republicans. Biden's strong backing for Israel faces pushback from many in his own party, who say he should be showing more support for the stateless Palestinians.
The assumption that the U.S. could at least be relied on to have the same policy over several different administrations, that's probably belongs to the past.
Ian Bremmer acknowledges the difficulties in finding permanent solutions to both wars. But he says the only real hope is for the U.S. to be fully engaged.
A world where you don't have global leadership, where the United States is increasingly unwilling to be the promoter of global values, you will get more conflict.
Today, there are calls for ceasefires and peace talks, but both wars are a long, long way from a permanent solution. Greg Myrie, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us, 8:19 now on this Friday. Coming up on the program later this hour, it's a Friday, so Wisconsin Life is on the way. Today, we're going to be continuing what we've been doing this week, taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from this year. We'll have the update on the life of a Cuban Wisconsinite who lives in La Crosse. He's featured on the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. That story is about 25 minutes away on WPR.
Thank you. Sunday evening, Simply Folk brings you 3 hours of great folk music, from string bands to bluegrass, Celtic, Americana, singer-songwriters, and lots more. For the best in traditional and contemporary folk music, join me, Sheila Shigley, this Sunday from 5 to 8 p.m. here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Overture Center for the Arts and Hanson's Garden Village. Your business or organization can partner in providing the WPR programs that enrich our communities. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support comes from Offsite, functioning as an integrated part of your business's IT staff, providing 24/7 support. Reduce your organization's technology risk by partnering with Offsite's team of local engineers. Visit off-site.com/radio.
Weather, some lingering rain in the southern part of the state this morning, eventually stopping by about the afternoon hours. Highs in the 30s and 40s throughout the state today. Calm and clear across Wisconsin tomorrow with high temperatures in the 30s. Chance for some precipitation on New Year's Eve Sunday with highs in the 30s once again. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at metamucil.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wild lands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Every year around this time, we remember a few of the musicians we lost in the past year. And we started 2023 with two big losses in rap. Gangsta Boo was the only woman in 3-6 Mafia. They revolutionized Southern hip hop. She was just 43 when she died on New Year's Day.
I light the candlesticks, a crucifix up at the tech place. The devil's daughter, Gangsta Boo, is out to catch a case.
Just 1 month later, one of the most innovative groups in hip-hop lost a founding member. De La Soul's David Jalakour, a.k.a. True Boy the Dove.
What I do ain't make-believe. People say I sit and try. But when it comes to being De La, it's just me, myself, and I.
Christmas is still in the air, and one of the most unusual holiday songs came from the late Shane McGowan, the Irish punk band The Pogues.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank.
Another Irish legend died this past year. Sinead O'Connor pushed back against many of the music industry's expectations and still landed one of the biggest hits of 1990. He was one of the great harmony singers in rock history. David Crosby was the voice of the 1960s California sound with the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
If I had ever been it before, I would probably know just what to do.
Don't you?
She was the voice behind the Grammy winner for Record of the Year in 1965. Astro Gilberto introduced a lot of Americans to Brazilian bossa nova. This year, Parrotheads lost their leader. Jimmy Buffett's music made you feel sand between your toes wherever you listened. He was 76.
Wasted away again in Margaritaville. Searching for my lost shaker of salt.
This summer, the guitarist for The Band left us. Robbie Robertson also wrote this absolute classic.
Take a look.
Put the load right on me.
There's really no way to emphasize this enough. Popular music owes a debt of gratitude to the Isley Brothers. Rudolph Isley died this fall. We lost a couple of America's greatest songwriters. From the Brill Building, Cynthia Wilde co-wrote songs like On Broadway, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, and this one for the Righteous Brothers. You lost that love and feeling. Whoa, that love and feeling. And Burt Bacharach co-wrote so many chart toppers. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, That's What Friends Are For, Close to You, and this one.
'Cause each time I see you, I break down and cry. Walk on by.
Harry Belafonte was so much more than a singer. He started his career as an actor, then became one of the leading voices of the civil rights movement. He died this year at the age of 96.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Tony Bennett was also 96 when he died this year. Bennett was one of the most expressive singers of his day, and his day lasted more than seven decades.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
Two of the greatest players in jazz died this past year. Wayne Shorter changed the sound of jazz with the fusion band Weather Report. Before that, he wrote for and played with Miles Davis. And Ahmad Jamal kept the jazz trio format vibrant in the 1960s. Ryoichi Sakamoto died this spring at the age of 71. He started his career playing electronic music, but became a force as a composer of delicate film scores. Two performers who broke racial barriers in classical music died this year. Mezzo-soprano Grace Bumbry became the first black woman to perform at Germany's prestigious Bayreuth Festival. And Andre Watts was one of the most celebrated concert pianists of the 1960s and 70s. In January, we lost a man who inspired and confounded guitarists around the world, Jeff Beck. That same month, Tom Verlaine died. In the 1970s, he led one of the breakthrough bands of New York's punk scene, Television.
Hesitating.
And we have just enough time to honor one more voice. She was without a doubt the queen of rock and roll. The great Tina Turner died in May. Just a few of the legends of music who left us in 2023. This is NPR News.
Hi, Barbie!
Barbie.
Hollywood has been on a roller coaster this year, from the peaks of Barbenheimer to the depths of actors and writers strikes. But film critic Bob Mondello says one thing that's up this year is the quality of the movies. His top 10 list on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30, today on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. Glad to have you with us on this Friday for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29 with news from NPR and WPR on the way.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Trump campaign says it will appeal the decision by Maine's Secretary of State to bar former President Donald Trump's name from the state's presidential primary ballot. The Colorado Supreme Court made a similar ruling earlier this month, deciding Trump's actions leading up to the January 6th attack at the U.S. Capitol amounted to insurrection. It cited Section 3 of the 14th Amendment in its ruling. Ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to decide the issue. A federal judge says lawmakers in Georgia can move forward with their redrawn political maps. Sam Greenglass, with member station WABE in Atlanta, says the judge, appointed by President Obama, ruled Republican lawmakers have complied with his order to rework the boundaries to include new majority black districts.
U.S. District Judge Steve Jones ordered Georgia's Republican-controlled legislature to create one new majority black congressional district. But instead, Republicans have managed to preserve their 9-5 advantage in Congress by dismantling a Democratic voting coalition district in suburban Atlanta. This was a district where black, Latino, and Asian American voters together formed a majority, and now they are split up.
That's Sam Greenglass reporting. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. A healthcare company in northeastern Wisconsin is helping to launch a new program to combat loneliness in the state's caregivers. Lakeland Care provides managed care for older adults and adults with disabilities in the state's Medicaid program. They've contracted with Pix Health to offer a new app to help with loneliness in caregivers. It provides activities and resources and a chance to talk with the person in their support center. Cindy Johnson is founder of Pix Health. She says family and other informal caregivers can be vulnerable to loneliness, either from the need to stay home with their loved one or just feeling like other people don't understand their situation.
They believe that they shouldn't be complaining or that it sounds like complaining because whomever they're caring for is much worse off than they are. And that's when loneliness can get very, very dangerous for caregivers.
A spokesperson for Lakeland says they're committed to providing the resource for at least 18 months and will work with organizations already serving caregivers in the state to get people enrolled. To promote outdoor recreation in the new year, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is organizing hikes on New Year's Day. Margaret Faust reports 21 state properties are offering guided tours.
First day hikes are meant to start the year off on the right foot. The goal is to get outside for fresh air and exercise. Kirby McDonald is a volunteer leading a hike in Interstate State Park on New Year's Day. He loves leading hikes because people tell him how they've been connected to the trails for generations. He also likes watching younger hikers explore nature for the first time.
They're really enjoying the time that they have outside in nature and experiencing things that they never experienced before and their eyes and their questions and their awe.
McDonald hopes these hikes will inspire people to kickstart habitual trips to state parks. Margaret Faust, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Flags across Wisconsin are flying at half staff today in honor of former Senator Herb Kohl. Governor Tony Evers issued the declaration yesterday. Flags will remain at half staff until sunset on the day Kohl is laid to rest. Kohl's foundation announced earlier this week that the former four-term senator from Wisconsin had passed away at the age of 88 after a brief illness. In weather, highs in the 30s and 40s across the state today with a bit of rain in the south. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware, partnering with chefs like Tom Colicchio to bring professional-grade cookware to restaurants and home kitchens. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. and from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm May Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Now, if you subscribe to Amazon Video, you might have noticed a lump of coal in your inbox recently, a notice that movies and TV shows on Prime Video are getting ads starting January 29th. Amazon began talking about a change like this earlier in the year. It eliminates the platform's long-standing commercial-free policy for streaming video, something many customers have grown very accustomed to. Here to tell us more about what's driving the change and what it means for streamers is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, I stream. I'm sure you stream. Most of us stream. What does this mean for us?
Well, of course, Amazon's not the first streamer to place ads in their content library, but when some other streaming services like Netflix wanted to feature ads inside their programming, they created a cheaper membership. Amazon's basically converting everyone who has Amazon Prime, which includes services beyond streaming, into an ad-supported streaming membership. So if you do nothing, then on January 29th, you'll begin to see what they're calling limited advertisements in movies and films. They say that there'll be fewer ads than on most broadcast, cable TV, or other streaming services.
Can I opt out of these ads?
Well, to keep your commercial-free experience, you have to sign up for a different tier and pay an extra $2.99 per month. Now, if you've got a current Amazon Prime membership, you're already paying about $15 per month or $139 if you pay a lump sum annually. Now, there's some people who pay just for access to Prime Video streaming alone. That's about $9 a month, and they still have to pay that extra $2.99 to avoid commercials.
All right, paying more, no ads. I always wondered about this, Eric. Why not just raise the prices for everyone and avoid ads altogether? I mean, it seems to make sense to me.
Well, my hunch is that it comes down to a few things. First, streaming services know that when they raise prices, that can make people cancel memberships. That's called churn. Now, Netflix had a serious crisis in 2022, for example, when they saw a dip in subscriptions right around when they raised their fees. Amazon's strategy means that most subscribers won't see their fees go up if they do nothing, which might limit churn. Now, another challenge that some of these streamers have when they start these ad-supported subscriptions is getting people to sign up for them in the first place. Now, Amazon's strategy ensures that a lot of Amazon Prime subscribers will probably see the advertisements, which might allow them to sell the ads at a higher price and attract more advertisers. And finally, if they don't create a cheaper subscription fee, a tier, then Amazon also isn't cutting into its potential revenue quite as much.
Now, as you pointed out, Amazon Prime subscribers get a lot more than just access to streaming video. Does that make it tougher to access the benefits to Amazon?
Well, Amazon says this is about increasing investment in content, but because Amazon Prime members get access to other features like free shipping, it's tough to know how much of that fee actually funds streaming. Now, we've seen competing services like Netflix, Disney Plus, Hulu raise their subscription fees, create ad-supported subscriptions, crack down on password sharing and bundle services, all in an attempt to squeeze more revenue out of subscribers while minimizing churn. Amazon's latest move isn't that surprising. It's kind of a step back to the old models of ad-supported platforms like cable TV and broadcasting, and it suggests that higher fees and more ads are something that most streaming customers are going to have to contend with in 2024.
Okay. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
And we want to note that Amazon is a financial supporter of NPR. In his recent year-end address to the nation, Russian President Vladimir Putin called for patience with the war in Ukraine, saying the country would meet its goals. But in Moscow, the war can often seem far away. NPR's Charles Maines found Russians determined to show patience of another kind by waiting for tickets to a ballet.
Ultimately, you can blame it on math. 1,700, that's how many people fit in Moscow's fabled Bolshoi Theater. Yet there are just 22 holiday performances of The Nutcracker, a beloved 19th century ballet by Russian composer Pyotr Tchaikovsky, heard here in a Bolshoi performance from 2014. So, 1,700 seats, 22 performances, which leaves around 37,000 Nutcracker tickets for a city of some 12 million, meaning at the Bolshoi, as in life, there are winners, but more often, losers. Outside the theater, hundreds of Russians brave sub-zero temperatures deep into the night in hopes of securing their golden ticket. We've been standing here for a long time, since 9 this morning, says Andrei, a Moscow University student who, like everyone in this story, agreed to speak on the condition his last name not appear in the American media. But we'll stay until the end, he adds, because the Nutcracker is worth it. It's such a beautiful ballet. I just wanted a chance to see it in my old age, says Raya, a retired cleaner who's lived in Moscow most of her life but never been to a Nutcracker production. And this gets to another issue. The Bolshoi sells only 400 Nutcracker tickets per day. And to get them, you have to stand in line. Most people I spoke with were on their second try after a melee broke out the night before. They opened the gates and the crowd just shoved us out of the way, says Zhenya, mother of two who works in the aviation industry. If people were more cultured, they would have seen that pensioners and others have been waiting all day long, she adds. Unfortunately, that's not the society we live in. On this night, riot police were on hand, but they mostly sat warm in their bus, the engine kicking acrid fumes over the same crowd police were in theory there to protect. If all of this, ballet, beauty, suffering, and scarcity, sound like Russian tropes, well, here's another. Corruption. What, you really think someone's not making money off of all of this, says Zhenya, glancing towards the front of the line? I'm supposed to stand here for 10 hours, admitted Beck, one of several migrant workers from Central Asia I met at the head of the queue. He's a hired gun, said one of his friends, as he and Beck gave a smile. In fact, people kept telling me all the ways a small fortune could be made for those looking to sell a spot in line. Russia, of course, is at war and under heavy Western sanctions because of it. But no one seemed to want to talk about Ukraine, and maybe with good reason. These days, the wrong opinion can easily land you in jail. Still, the conflict was there, lurking just off stage. As I joked that an endless line felt like something out of the USSR, Raya, a retired pensioner, told me she really did have nostalgia for the Soviet days. Honestly, things were so much calmer then. Today there's that little war. Her voice trailing off. Andre, the university student, told me that during hard times, Russians gravitated towards art. To stand in line and talk to people, to listen to music and watch ballet, it brings me joy, he said. Meanwhile, Zhenya, the aviation worker, said if there was ever a time to see the Nutcracker, it was now. With Russia cut off from Europe and traveled to other destinations, astronomically expensive. You can't go anywhere these days, she says. And so, with New Year's just around the corner, she returns to the line, hoping for a different kind of ticket to better times. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you with us. About 18 minutes left in the show this hour. And of course, we've got Wisconsin Life coming up in just a couple of minutes. This week, we're taking a look back on our favorite stories from 2023. The story that we'll hear in just a few minutes features the life of a Cuban Wisconsinite who lives in La Crosse and is featured on the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. It's about 3 minutes away on WPR.
Celebrate traditions old and new this holiday season with special programs all this month. Hi, I'm Sarah Ashworth, director of WPR. Find beautiful music, friendly conversation, and engaging entertainment to keep you company at home, at work, and on the go. Explore the full schedule of seasonal programs at WPR.org/holidays, and thanks for listening.
Support for WPR comes from the Festival Choir of Madison and the Rainbow Project. Join the team of organizations that support a wide variety of informative and inspiring programs for the people of Wisconsin. More at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support comes from UW Parkside's Adventures in Lifelong Learning, offering seniors a variety of book clubs to stay engaged. All books all the time, great books, and nonfiction books, plus a poetry group. These clubs meet via Zoom. To learn more, visit uwp.edu/ALL.
Radio at 844, here's what's happening in news. Russia has launched more than 100 missiles and more than 20 drones against Ukraine overnight in the biggest aerial assault of the war so far. That's according to the Associated Press. Ukraine says most of those were intercepted, but at least 18 civilians were killed.
The state of Maine has become the second in the country to bar former President Donald Trump from the ballot in 2024. Colorado became the first state to bar him from the ballot earlier this month. Meanwhile, a liberal political action committee associated with the Northwoods Brewery in Wisconsin wants courts to bar former President Trump from Wisconsin ballots. And a former university head says the universities of Wisconsin Board of Regents violated his rights when they unanimously voted to fire him on Wednesday. More news at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition on WPR, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. This week, we're revisiting some of our favorite stories from 2023. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with an update on the life of a Cuban Wisconsinite who lives in La Crosse. He's featured on the podcast, WPR Reports, Uprooted.
Ernesto Rodriguez came to Wisconsin in the summer of 1980. That's after making a treacherous journey on a fishing boat from Cuba to the United States. Quickly after arriving on shore, Erne was shipped off to Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin. And it's in the military base's kitchen that he got a crash course in American food from a local cook.
One day he said, "Are you guys like macaroni and cheese? What the hell is macaroni and cheese?"
Erne has come to love mac and cheese and burgers. But as he first told us in the podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted, he also still cooks traditional Cuban food like congri and chicken fricasse. Erne has embraced life in Wisconsin, but has never let go of his Cuban roots. He's lived between two worlds, only able to walk in one of them, the U.S. He's dreamed of returning to Cuba for a visit.
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is go to my hometown, see if I recognize where I used to live, and then spend the time with my family in Florida.
Erne has been a permanent resident of the U.S. for decades, but he wasn't able to become a citizen due to paperwork issues with his Cuban birth certificate. That means he couldn't vote or get a U.S. passport to travel. That is, until fall 2023. Ernesto Rodriguez traveled to Minnesota, where he took part in a naturalization ceremony.
All right, if everybody can please raise your right hand. And you're going to repeat after me. I hereby declare.
After reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, Erne received his certificate of naturalization. He was beaming.
Yeah, American citizen. I'm happy. I'm excited. You know, it's big, big stuff.
He waited more than 40 years for this moment.
I feel released now because now I can vote. Now I can apply to be Lacroix mayor.
He may be joking about running for mayor, but he's very serious about getting to vote. Erne grew up in Cuba and has only just become a U.S. citizen. He's in his mid-60s, and he's never voted in an election.
In 40 years I've been here, I have a sixth president, Jimmy Carter, Reagan, Bush.
He keeps up with politics in the news, so this is a huge deal to finally be able to participate in the democratic process. As for Erne's other lifelong dream, going back to visit Cuba, now that he can actually do it, he has some mixed feelings.
The only way I can go to Cuba is the whole government thing is throw away, throw to the garbage. If Cuba be free, then I can go there.
Erne is wary of the Cuban government. He misses his family, but even his sister discourages him from visiting. It's partially because he's been speaking out against the government and communism.
Cuba, you say, I don't like Castro, and there's people watching you, and they put you in prison for no reason.
Standing proudly next to Erne is Michelle Pinzel. They've been close friends for nearly two decades, so this day is emotional for her, too.
It's just incredible to see how patient and how diligent Ernesto has been in all of these years.
While Erne waits to vote and thinks about visiting Cuba, he has other things he wants to tackle first as a citizen.
enjoying my life in a great country, America. Work to improve my life a little more and maybe buy a house and be this comedy, you know, stand comedy, make a joke.
But before he launches his stand-up comedy career, Irne is taking the day to celebrate. His first stop, lunch at a Cuban restaurant in the Twin Cities. His second stop, the Mall of America, so he can find a shirt or hat that features the U.S. and Cuban flags. To learn more about Irne's life in Cuba and Wisconsin, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted at wpr.org/uprooted. Big thanks to Mark Rickers for recording the audio for this story in Minneapolis. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR.
Support comes from UW Parkside's Adventures in Lifelong Learning, offering a current affairs discussion group trying to solve the problems of the day by searching for solutions that seem to elude politicians, economists, and leaders in business, labor, and education. To learn more, visit uwp.edu/ALL.
WPR.org.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather, some light rain in the southern part of the state to start the day. That should be clearing by about the afternoon, with highs in the 30s and 40s today. Clear and calm across the state tomorrow, with high temperatures in the 30s. And a good chance for some precipitation on New Year's Eve, but nothing really accumulating. Highs in the 30s once again. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. 4 years ago, Ghana launched a campaign to welcome people from the African diaspora back to the continent of their ancestors. The country has even created a settlement offering free land to transplants so they can build homes and businesses. But as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports, that settlement has become a source of bitterness.
Dozens of houses are dotted across Pan-African Village, a rural settlement enveloped by miles of lush farmland and palm trees near the Atlantic coast.
Nobody has ever lived there before. It was idle land.
Lenville Skyer says he was the first to settle here 3 years ago and says he'll never leave. We meet in the lounge of his six-bedroom home and guest house.
I was born on the island of Jamaica, a couple months before 1950, right? So I'm an old man now, or oldish.
He lived and worked in Canada for over 40 years, but never felt he really belonged.
We as blacks and native people are regarded as second-class citizens. We've reached a stage now where there is an option to find land, countries where you can be totally free.
So when he retired, he considered starting a new life elsewhere. And then in 2019, Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, launched a major campaign.
Fellow Ghanaians, we have dubbed this year the Year of Return.
The Year of Return was a call to the African diaspora to come back to the continent and to Ghana. Thousands of black people like Skyers arrived, encouraged to visit or even settle. Then he found out about a project offering free land in a settlement within the town of Asebu, along Ghana's Cape Coast. So we're walking through a dirt road that parts through this 5,000-acre expanse of lush farmland. That's Pan-African Village. That's a diaspora settlement donated or offered by a local traditional ruler to any black diasporas wanting to come back to Ghana. All around me, there are clusters of homes that have already been built and many of them under construction, dotted all across this vast expanse of land. Moyen Vivili is among a small community of people living permanently in Pan-African Village. She was born in Jamaica and then lived most of her life in the US. Then she moved from Atlanta, Georgia last year, and soon after, she says she was given a new title.
My name is Na Buhafoyena Oyen Mempese Tulu the First. My title is Diaspora Development Queen for Ghana.
I meet her in her living room, sitting on a wooden throne, her feet on a stool that rests on a lion skin rug. She's dressed in kente fabric, traditional Ghanaian clothing, draped over her shoulder. She says she was crowned by chiefs from the Gar ethnic group.
I was concerned about my retirement, and the money that I was going to get for my Social Security could not pay a light bill or water rate.
But things turned around on a visit to Ghana. She acquired two plots of land and built a large two-story house last year.
It was a salvation for me. I felt free.
I ask her what she thinks about life here.
In Ghana, people are humble. They don't need much to live. Food is the most important to a lot of people in Ghana. You understand? Okay, so they don't even need a fork. They use their hands. I mean, it sounds like poverty, but when you think about it, how much do we really need to survive?
A lot of local people that we've spoken to feel like the diaspora have an advantage over them when they come here because they have foreign currency, they have access to land that they don't have access to.
Yes, they should own. If you're here as a Ghanaian, you should be able to own your own land and build your own home. So it's not our fault. We didn't get anything free.
But the local traditional ruler puts it differently, from his palace on a hill overlooking the town. Okatachi Dr. Amanfi VII is known as the paramount chief of Asebu and created the Pan-African Village project there.
I wanted to show to our diaspora brothers that we care for them. They are from Africa.
It's among a growing number of diaspora settlements that have emerged since the year of return.
My last check showed that we have about 560 people. Who have already taken land.
The land is free, and the only charges are what he calls administration fees of about $1,000 per plot. I ask him whether local people in Asebu have had similar opportunities.
Every Ghanaian must have access to land. Yeah, so no, irrespective of whether you are a rural or whatever, you must have access to land. Land is life.
But he evades the question, and some, like 59-year-old Kwesi Otubensil, have even had their land taken away.
So we have been farming there for so many years, for generations.
We meet outside his modest home with other farmers and members of his extended family.
I used to farm lime, coconuts, oranges, that it has been destroyed.
They are among hundreds who used to farm on the land that belonged to their family for at least four generations, until the chief argued that as a traditional ruler of the town, he had the power to give it away. The family refute this and have taken him to court. They show me a copy of a high court order suspending any construction there, but the construction hasn't stopped. 44-year-old Daniel Kweku is another farmer in the family. He says when they went to challenge the diaspora's building there, they were threatened with guns.
Some of the diasporans told us they have guns. Idea places. So if they went there again, they will shoot us.
And now he's too afraid to go back there again. And he says they feel they've been hunted from their land. 68-year-old Ebuseben Kojobedu is the head of the family. He says when he first heard about the settlement, he supported it until he was told his land of 123 acres would be given away. He says the chief told him the land was not sold, but given away to the diaspora for free. So he wouldn't be paid for it.
No compensation. It means if I don't fight for it, my family property is going to be lost.
But like many legal battles over land, the case will likely take many years. All while more settlements are set to emerge, offering the dream of a new life in Africa. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Cape Coast, Ghana.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Alex Crow. And that'll do it for Morning Edition on this Friday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. And thanks to John Davis for always helping bring us the news here on WPR. That news is on the way.
What started with one experimental license more than 100 years ago is today Wisconsin Public Radio. With dozens of stations around the state and a comprehensive website at WPR.org. Members have made this remarkable journey possible. Thank you.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity that encourages community members to build a legacy for themselves and their families through tax-advantaged giving. To learn how, visit kenoshafoundation.org or call 262-654-2412.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and